So I'm going to introduce the speakers in a second. This is a kind of a more informal, kind of fun tour of Winnelec Now, which is our online training service, similar to Skillsoft and Lynda.com and Pluralsight. A couple of housekeeping notes. One is, Jeffrey and I almost always, you know, 99% of the time, do deep dive technical talks. So when we do a case study, I'm going to take you through some of the history and some of the, you know, what this product is and, you know, value proposition. So in other words, kind of marketing slides. And the reason I'm telling you this is that's totally out of our comfort zone because we train ourselves not to do any marketing and sales because developers hate that. But I wanted to talk you through how we came to build this thing, how we got here, the reasons we did it and what it is. I'll probably only take 10 minutes or so, maybe 15, do a demo of it, and then we'll dive in with Jeffrey to some of the architecture key points, and I'll explain why we thought it might be interesting to do this talk as we go through it. The second housekeeping point is, when we submitted this, we submitted for a small 45-minute breakout session, and they gave us 75 minutes, so you're going to have at least a half an hour of free time to hang out and do email or ask Q&A at the end of this talk. We're not going to try to stretch this out to 75 minutes. So my name is Todd Fine. I'm CEO of Winnelec. I'll talk about the company in a second. You have my information there if you want to email me or Jeffrey later. And much more important than me is Jeffrey Richter. So you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Jeffrey Richter. I'm a software engineer. I work full-time at Microsoft now on the Azure Service Fabric team, but I'm also a co-founder of Winnelec, and I worked at Winnelec for many, many years of my life. Most people are familiar with me from the various books that I've authored over the past 20 or so years, about 18 books in total. I put the three most recent book covers up here on the slide. And then at the bottom is my Winnelec email address and my LinkedIn information, if anybody wants to befriend me there, and my Twitter handle is there as well.
Okay. And, you know, hopefully you're familiar with Jeffrey. He's one of the reasons I came to the company. He's kind of a legend in the Microsoft and architecture arena. And it's one of the reasons why we wanted to do this talk, because this is a product where Jeffrey was not working with any other company. He had no managers, and he had free reign to build whatever he wanted in any architecture he wanted exactly the way he wanted, which is why we thought it'd be a little bit of a fun talk, because when you see some product out there or some cool piece of software, it could be small, it could be big, it could be enterprise, it could be cloud. As a developer, I always kind of go, I wonder how they actually built that. You know, technology changes every 6 months here. I wonder how they actually did it. And some of the things that Jeffrey did when he built this are kind of interesting and definitely unique, which is one of the couple reasons we thought it would be interesting to do this talk. Okay, very simple agenda. I'm just going to go over a little bit of the history of how we got here, how we decided to build this service, and do a quick product demo, tell you a little bit about the service. Then Jeffrey will jump in for the bulk of the presentation and talk about some of the key pieces of the architecture. And if there's any questions, we'll probably have 45 minutes to answer your questions. Okay, so how did we come to build this? And I will demo it in a few minutes, but just so you know who Winnelec is, we are a Microsoft partner. All the bulk of our work, you know, nowadays with modern web development and that kind of stuff isn't really on the Microsoft platform per se, but we have three lines of business. We have a consulting business, which is application development architecture. We have a hardcore developer training business, which is in-person training at companies around the world. And then in 2013, we added a third line of business, which is our on-demand Winnelec Now service that we're talking about today. That is just taking our developer training and putting it online for scale. So here's a really simple, high-level kind of timeline. Winnelec was founded in 2000. At that time, we were only an instructor-led training company, very hardcore. I always considered ourselves one of the top two or three in the country, if not the world, along with competitors like Developmentor and that kind of thing. We always knew each other very closely in the industry. So we initially were that kind of top-tier developer hardcore training company. We added consulting in 2005, 2006, which is really application development. And then in 2013, as I said, we added this third service called Winnelec Now. So now I'm going to talk about how we kind of came to make the decision to build this. We had been, for 13, 14 years, Microsoft Corp's number one outside training vendor for their internal developers. I don't mean for just people that were developers in the Microsoft stack. I mean for Microsoft developers. We put somewhere between 35 to 50,000 of their developers through our training. We were a required set of curriculums for some of the subsets of engineers, like people on the OS team to take some of Jeffrey's courses. And every single one of those years, we had the highest instructor ratings of any other vendor. So we had this big presence with Microsoft. We had this huge reputation in hardcore developer training. And in 2012, we saw a couple things. One is we saw the market that you all see, right? Online training, MOOCs, all this kind of stuff. You see lynda.com, you see the rise of Pluralsight that we all know. We know those, all those guys. We know the owners of, or the owners that were the owners of lynda.com. And we know Aaron Skonner from Pluralsight. So we're all in that mix. We saw the market happening. We said maybe we should kind of do something ourselves because we have this great brand. And at that same time, Microsoft, who was, again, our number one customer for instructor-led training, we were going all over the world. We still do, you know, in Denmark and Beijing and India and Hyderabad and everywhere. I mean, you know, millions of dollars worth of training for Microsoft Corp developers around the world. They said they saw the same marketing trends that we did, and they said, can you take all your training and make an online version of it available so we can scale it even more and even more cheaply? So our biggest customer of our training wanted to take it online. We started thinking about taking it online. We had that industry reputation and we had that industry expertise, and everything really just lined up. We were already doing consulting and app dev. We knew how to produce content. We knew how to train. We knew how to present. And because we are software developers, we knew how to build a platform. It just all made sense. So we said, let's do it. And we really kind of did this all on our own. We didn't take any investor funding. We just wanted to kind of extend what we already have been doing. And that's how we came to make the decision to start Winalight now. So it's a terrible slide, right? But just to be clear about what this is an online developer training focused service, works worldwide, scales to hundreds of thousands or millions of users, which Jeffrey will talk about. And it's also become more and more integrated with Microsoft. So Winalight now is already offered as of November of last year, as part of the new back then, Dev Essentials program, which is kind of that free MSDN tier type of thing that people get worldwide, and it's a benefit you get for free if you sign up through that program. It's now also being offered parts of it in subsets on Microsoft Virtual Academy, and there's more and more of those partnerships things that are coming on with different Microsoft groups, because although Microsoft has a lot of 100, 200 level content, they don't have very much 300 and 400 level content. And almost everything we have is just very deep, premium level, hardcore, developed by experts training. So they're asking for more and more of that. And there's some bigger things coming that I think even you don't know about right now, Jeffrey. I'll tell you afterwards. So that relationship with Microsoft is expanding. The service is successful and makes money. But it's also not a Pluralsight or Lynda bringing in, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year and a million users. So it's this kind of thing we use on the side that's profitable, but we've never really invested the money to have it kind of take off in a national type basis. I don't know why that's important. It's just that you may have heard of it, you may have not. But it's equal or much better than some of those other services out there in terms of the quality of the content. And I don't know if I'll have time to show you that, but you should check it out. And if you want to check it out, I gave a promo code. You can go right to the site, go sign up, go to the promo code screen, and you get, I don't remember how much I put in there, a month or 3 months or something for free, and you can check out the entire service, you know, all facilities, all videos for free. And if you have any trouble with that, look up the slides or talk to me later, and you can email me and say, I couldn't get in or something happened, and I'll get you in. You guys can check it out. Okay. So what were the goals of this when Jeffrey decided to build it? We wanted to build it on the latest platform because there's a lot of cons for not being first in doing this, but one of the benefits is you can start with the latest technologies. So we wanted to build it on the latest technologies. We wanted to build the whole thing on the cloud, and we chose Azure. We wanted it to be, and this is getting to Jeffrey's area, very, very highly optimized for cost. That was one of the key design features, and very, very scalable to millions of users. And that was the focus, I think. Is that correct, Jeffrey?
That's correct.
So,
because I'm very cheap. I want to run this thing real cheap.
Yeah, and it's funny because we've gone into some of those other companies that I've mentioned, talking to them about various things, about sharing content, licensing content, buying content, and we've met the owners and CEOs, and we've seen what they pay for this stuff. And some of them are on internal racks, some of them are on AWS, but all of them pay an order of magnitude or two more than our system costs, just because it was built for that from the very beginning, from the ground up. So very simple, highly cost optimized, highly scalable, and Jeffrey will talk about that. There's my marketing slide. This actually is a marketing slide that I put into this. But you might ask what's different about it. On the one hand, not much, right? You can go to Udemy. You can go to any of these 4, 5, 6, 8 online training services. And they all share a lot of things. We did design this build this in a few different ways that may or may not matter to you. One is a lot of the content here that I told you was required curriculums for Microsoft's operating system engineers, meaning people working on the OS or people working on Azure. I mean, Jeffrey's taught dozens of deep Azure classes to Microsoft. John Robbins, the Bug Slayer columnist from MSDN, is one of our founders and owners as well. That entire series of classes that Microsoft hardcore engineers gets is on here. And you won't get that from other places. Now, we don't have 5,000 videos. We have 400 or 500 at the moment. It keeps growing every month. But a lot of those videos seriously are unique. We also said we can't compete with, you know, lynda.com or Pluralsight in terms of scale when we're doing everything ourselves and they're getting 100, 200 million in outside investor funding. So we've consciously priced this to be the best value pricing, meaning you're getting the same quality content videos, but it's much cheaper because we're not going to try to beat the other guys and take them on head on. And the rest is really just typical marketing stuff, so I'll stop there. I'm about to demo it. So is there any questions before I give you a really quick 5-minute demo? Okay. And you'll be happy to know that after that, it gets technical again. So for those of you guys who haven't seen it, let me find my old people glasses, put this on, and let's start here. So I'm just going to log in. I'm going to make this really brief. I mean, it's not that there's tons of incredibly unique things to show you here, but at least want you to know what you're looking at so when Jeffrey's showing you stuff, you can kind of relate it visually. So you log on. Each person has a dashboard. You can set up queues and favorites and bookmarks and say, I want to do this whole course series in this order. And you just go to that dashboard. You can see your video history, et cetera, et cetera. You can go to a course library. There's various ways to look at it. You can just kind of look at the whole thing. You can filter it by author, like Jeffrey Richter. And let's see how good the internet is here. Let's click on one, see if this works. OK, I can't hear it, but I don't know if you guys can hear any of this.
You can put your microphone next.
You can't hear that at all, can you?
Get managed thread ID, so we can see the ID of the thread that's executing this function. And we see it has an ID of 1. That is my primary thread for application. Now I'm going to go and call
okay. So it's a typical online training service. There's discussion forums, there's bookmarks, there's tables of contents. You can skip around. Let me stop this so I can hear myself. There is related code and samples when they exist that you can download. It could be a PowerPoint, it could be code samples, that kind of thing. So all the typical stuff you would normally see. There is series of content. So MVC5 fundamentals. Here's that mastering.NET debugging. You might have seen mastering.NET performance tuning. It's not all .NET. There's tons of PHP and Facebook and Linux and all kinds of other stuff on there. But if you want to see a series, and the reason I'm bringing this up is that this is, I would say, a unique series from John Robbins, who is one of the top debugging experts literally in the world, works with the Microsoft debugging teams with Visual Studio. He has his book, Mastering.NET Debugging, his book, Mastering, Bugging with C++, all this kind of stuff. So this is an example of an entire course series and some unique content. And this is much less important. There's the instructors that you can check out. We always try to highlight the instructors to give them some marketing props. And there's an admin section, which you would not see, but that lets us look at all kinds of accounts, users, promo codes. I mean, I might want to go here and be careful what I show here this time. Let's look at, let's just bring up an account, MVP, see if that works. If you're an MVP, we give free accounts out to MVPs worldwide. Let's see. All right. Oh, I just clicked the wrong button. I'm sorry. Yep. I don't know what's going on there. I just had it up. Let me show you one. Oh, there it comes up. So there's 1,150 in this one account, a little over 1,000 people. And I got to be careful what I click on, because if I click on the wrong thing, you'll see everybody's email addresses. But there's a bunch of things for a business portal in here, none of which really applies too much to what Jeffrey's going to show you, because he's going to show you the architecture internals. But I think I have one other thing I wanted to show real quickly here, and this is that same MVP account. And there should be a bunch of user administration stuff and logs and things like that. There's all kinds of kind of reporting that our customers can get. So for instance, let's pick on one of these. You can get graphs of video history, which people are watching videos, so that if you're an enterprise buying this stuff, and you can download Excel spreadsheets and all kinds of stuff, you can say, hey, I'm paying Wintellect all this money because you, Josh, said you wanted to, you know, get this video and study it, but I see you didn't watch any videos last month, so I'm taking you out and I'm putting in somebody else who's going to watch it. So there's all kinds of kind of business-related functionality in there as well, which doesn't really apply to what we're going to talk about, but that kind of gives you, I guess a five-minute overview of what the system is. Anything else you wanted me to hit in the demo before you show it? Is there anything else you would want to show?
No, I think that's the bulk of the features that are interesting.
I think the things that were, you know, hard for us or hard for Jeffrey, maybe not hard, but that you had to think about was, it's like anything. You can make this work. You guys could design this if 10 people were using it. But what if a million people are using it? And what about the storage for that? What about the streaming for that? What is the cost going to be for bandwidth when you are streaming to 100,000 people? And it's working, it must work worldwide in India and Australia and everything like that. What are the storage costs? We're on the cloud, right? So if you're storing stuff in blobs or tables or whatever, it always starts out really cheap. But then when you get to that scale, even in Azure, it starts to add up. And that's what Jeffrey's going to talk about. That's what he was considering, among many other things: memory performance, storage performance, cost optimizations. And that was the key focus, I think, for you when you were building it.
Sure.
Jeffrey didn't really
have to build ourselves? Is another one, right? what can we leverage?
And Jeffrey, you didn't really have any, at least minimal participation with the front end, really, or those portal stuff at all, except to support it from the back end. Is that correct?
Right. So I architected the system. I focused heavily on the back end, which is what I'll be talking about in the architecture slides. And then we had some contractors who did the front end, you know, making it look nice. I'm not an HTML user interface person, but we made sure that all the features propagated through from the back end to the front end, of course. And then we redid the UI. We hired a full-time employee, and then we redid the UI with Joel. And then
Microsoft just hired away from us a few months ago.
And then, but now Jeff is doing a lot of the UI stuff.
Right.
But the back-end architecture, my understanding is it's been pretty much, I mean, it works really well. It's been running that way for a couple of years. Other than a couple of tweaks here and there, maybe over time, it's largely good. There was a major re-architect between version 1 and version 2. Once we started getting feedback from customers, when I was working with the front-end guy, and we're thinking, we have to improve the user interface for this experience, and doing that really meant that we should change things on the back end. So there was a point in time where we did a pretty significant re-architecture of how we stored things in data storage. And then we had to migrate from one set of Azure tables to the new format for the Azure tables. And we did it the cheap way, which was by having downtime without trying to do it with them and being up the entire time. So over a weekend, we went down for a couple hours while we did that migration, and then we came back up. Other than that, it runs. And I don't know if you've had any other outages or...
I don't think we've ever had an outage due to anything on the app itself. It would just be like your normal, if Azure was down for a minute or some CDN thing would happen, and nothing it's even worth talking about, meaning it wasn't ever down.
I remember
for
we had a certificate problem. John Robbins went and had to get a copy of our certificate from our certificate provider. And when they did that, they revoked the previous one. So, and we didn't realize that. So there were some people who couldn't connect for a while until we figured that out, and then we had to do something to fix the certificate. I wrote a blog post about it if you want to know about that. It's on the Wintellect website. But that was years ago. Everything's
been smooth since then. Yeah, there's never actually, I'm just being honest, there's never been an architecture problem with performance or outages due to anything you did, Jeffrey. It's always been some Azure or network issue. Or as you know, the focus on optimization and scale sometimes took over from the how do we maintain this thing, you know, user perspective. But again, the back end has survived completely intact. Yeah.
So another thing for me was I was learning a lot about Azure at the time. So this was what, 2013 we're saying was the
2013 was when you were building it, yeah.
So I had been working with Azure prior to that, and I'd been working with some customers, and I'd been working with some people at Microsoft, but I'd never really architected anything from scratch entirely.
Let me interrupt just for 30 seconds, because if you guys don't know Jeffrey, he's you know, a superstar in that Microsoft arena in terms of architecture. And I'll just mention two things you worked on. You've worked on some of the internals of building the CLR.
True.
You're working right now on the internals of Service Fabric.
True.
So, you know, when Jeffrey's working, you know, he gets to pick and choose a lot of projects or what he wants to work on, whether it's threading and the garbage collector or whatever. And he's a master of that internal code optimization. Now, we're not talking about building a UI or look at this cool Electron app. We're talking about architecting for optimization, speed, and performance, and that's almost your entire background.
Yeah,
so just to make sure people know where you're coming from, because it's a pretty premium, rare skill set. It's not my skill set. I was a regular developer. I would develop for the line of business parts, you know?
Well, I grew up with a TRS-80. It had 4K of RAM and 4K of ROM. That's all we had. And so I had to learn to make everything work and fast on that kind of really low-end hardware at the time. So when this project came along, I was really excited about it, and I knew it was an opportunity for me to learn a lot about it. And you know, since it is my company, Wintellect, that we were going to benefit from it, I really tried to invest heavily in it, try to keep costs down, architect for scale, because we had no customers initially. We're hoping to get a lot of customers in the future. We don't want to re-architect it and rewrite it as those customers come on board. We want them to have a great experience. So these were all the things I was thinking about as I was building out the system. Furthermore, we had to have a lot of conversations about the business model. What are we going to charge? What kind of features, like the queues and the bookmarks, and we had gotten feedback from people who used competitor sites like Pluralsight that enterprises want to pay for like so many seat months, like 100 seats per month, and then move their employees in and out of those seats to watch videos, and then they want to be able to track what those employees have watched. So we talked to a bunch of these customers, and we gathered all this feedback and input, and then we used all of this to go and architect this system. All right, so I'm going to walk through the main architecture key points of the system now. So we have a video library XML file, because a few years ago, XML seemed to be more popular than JSON, and so it's still an XML file to this day. And this is just an enormous XML file that is read whenever we run on Azure in cloud services, so whenever a web role boots up, and so we can scale in and scale out dynamically using the cloud services model in Azure. Whenever a virtual machine boots up and it goes and joins our cluster, if you will, upon boot, it goes and reads this video library XML file. This file contains in it our entire library information. So the name of all the videos, the name of all the instructors, which instructor is responsible for that video, the subsections within the video, the title of the subsection, the time within the video where that subsection begins, links to any of the collateral material that Todd showed you, like where the slides can be downloaded, demos can be downloaded, and so on. All of that is in this file. And as I said, it's just read by each virtual machine when it boots up. And so once they read it, then they will periodically go back to see if this file changes. And we store this file in blob storage, in Azure Blob Storage. And one of the reasons, like a lot of times people would ask me, why didn't we put this in a SQL database? Why didn't we put this in an Azure table? Why didn't we use some other kind of store for it? Why do you use something so simple as this XML file? Because now we can't do searches and things like that. Well, first of all, the amount of information in here is not that much. It's really metadata. It's certainly not the video content itself is not in this file. And by having it as a separate file like this, if we ever decide that, let's say, Azure's having problems and we want to move to some other cloud service like Amazon, the file's going to move trivially. Whereas if we put it in, let's say, SQL Azure or an Azure table, then we have to write code to migrate this data over. This can also be read atomically, whereas because we're uploading new videos all the time and we're changing things in here. So because blob storage is a atomic store, right? When you upload something new, it won't erase the old thing until the new thing is up there in its entirety. We don't have to worry about race conditions that are happening. Whereas if you had things that were being added to a database or a table, you might be adding records for the sections of a video while something else is reading those sections of the video at the same time, and then you end up with some corrupted state where maybe something has read, but it doesn't know all of the sections of a particular video because the timing was just off. Another reason for this is that we have mobile clients now. Like, you can download an iOS client app for Wintellect now, and on the client app, you want to see all the videos that are possible in the sections. Well, the client app can periodically go back into blob storage and just read this file, and then we can put a nice user interface on top of it to show you that, as opposed to a chatty interface going back and forth to some kind of database to get all the different pieces of information. So this is much faster, it's atomic, we can move it between cloud services, and blob storage is actually cheaper than Azure Tables as well, and so that's another benefit. Todd, I don't know what you're doing. All right, fine. All right.
So the whole thing is responsive web and works on, you know, any device, and there's client application.
Yes, turn the mic back.
Client application versions of it for iOS, Android, and Windows. So that kind of goes back to what you were saying. So you can download these when you're a subscriber, watch them on an airplane while you're sitting there. And I just wanted to get that out because you were mentioning
how
easy it is to separate the UI and the rest of it. So let me start this up again for you.
Okay. All right, now don't move.
I won't.
All right. Then each virtual machine will periodically go back to blob storage approximately every 5 minutes or so, and will ask if there's a new version of this file. And usually there isn't a new version of the file, in which case it's just one quick I/O request, which were billed for the I/O request. But it's, you know, making I/O requests in Azure Storage is really, really cheap. I forget what the number is now, but it's incredibly cheap. So once every 5 minutes, I don't know, maybe adds up to like a quarter a year. It's like 25 cents a year. It's really cheap to do that. So if the file hasn't changed, which is the usual case, then there's nothing to download, and then the VM just uses all the metadata it currently has. But if it makes the request and the library has changed because we've uploaded some new files, new videos to the system, then it will download the new video library XML file in its entirety. We parse the XML, and then we do an atomic replace of it within the VM. And so not all VMs are absolutely in sync with each other, but it's an eventual consistency model, and it tends to work really well. And usually within 5 minutes, all the VMs are going to be up to date anyway. And then, as I mentioned, it's client downloadable. This is for the client-side apps that Todd was just showing you a moment ago.
Yes, we didn't have to migrate anything. We didn't have to say, hey, what's the data storage on this little device we're doing? We just had that XML file. It just worked.
Yes, in all these different places. Okay, we do give cheaper pricing to people in certain countries, like India, for example. And so when people log into the system, we have to know what country they're coming from. And when they watch a video, we need to know what country they're coming in from that request to go and watch the video. So we have to go from the customer's IP address to try to determine what country that they're in. And there's numerous ways to do that. There are web services out on the internet where when the person's logging in, we get their IP address, and then we can make a web request to this other service, pass in the IP address, and it'll tell us what country it is. And that was one thing we strongly considered, but there were several reasons why we ended up ruling it out. The first was that there is a latency involved with that. So we'd be making these requests to another service. I don't know how long it's going to take for that service to come back. Or what if that service is down? Then do we not let the person log in? Do we not let them watch videos? And if it's up, there's that latency thing. So we didn't like that. So instead, there are other services where you can go, and you can get an IP to country, comma separated file. And we can download this file periodically from these other services. And so we do that, like once a month or so. We go and we grab this file from some service. We take the file in its entirety, and we put it up in blob storage. Again, that file is read by each of our virtual machines at boot time. So we have a mapping in memory of all the IP address ranges to what country those things are in. And then once a day, we reread this file because we don't have to keep it up to date all that often. But really, as I said earlier, we really only update the file about once a month. But the VMs poll for a change once a day. And as I said at the bottom, it is seldom updated. So now we don't have a dependency on an external service. Each VM can operate in parallel. There's no latency issue because the file is there on the VM. So we can just easily look up anything that we need to convert an IP to a country for some of our internal logic related to billing. The promo code, Todd showed you that you could log into the system, and for you guys, you can use a promo code of Ignite 2016. So when people register with the system, they have an option of putting in a promo code. The promo code might give them discounted pricing or might let them use the service for free for some number of hours or for some number of months or something like that. So we have an Azure table that has promo codes in it, and we have some administrative tools where a person like Todd can go and say, I'm going to Ignite conference, I need to generate a promo code, this will be the name of it, and anybody who signs in with this promo code, here's the features that they get to use with that code. And then that information goes into an Azure table. When a person goes and registers and they have a place where they can put in a promo code, we go to the Azure table, we look that up, then we know how to initialize their account with how much free time they have and so on, what videos they can watch, et cetera. As videos are being watched, we pay royalties to the authors who produce the videos. So, and we do that once a quarter. So at the end of each quarter, we need to look up and see, for this video, how many views or how many minutes of it were watched? For this video, how many minutes of it were watched? And so on. So we have another Azure table for that, which is our video statistics table. And as people are watching videos, we are periodically updating a counter in this table. So it's we're just going right to a particular video, and we're just adding one to a counter property in there. So the information we keep in the table, I try to keep it really small and sweet, because the more information you have, the more expensive it's going to be to pay for that table, you know, year in and year out, because we're charged for gigabytes per month on it. Also, we want to make it small because we want to update it very quickly. So you have to read the current number, add one, and write the number back out. And then Azure tables use a pessimistic concurrency model, no, optimistic concurrency model with that. And so, so we have to have retry loops in our code and things like that, but the likelihood of multiple people watching the same video and we're trying to update it at the same time is very unlikely, so there's not a lot of contention on it, which means the performance of it is very good. And the costs, again, are low. Because retries will also cost you money. We want to try to reduce retries as much as possible in the code. It costs you time and it costs you money. The real bread and butter of the service, though, are the user accounts. And there are several things that are associated with a user. So first of all, a user has their login information, and we use an email address to log you in. All the password information is completely encrypted. We don't store any financial information anywhere on the site. We never even ask it of you. So we don't have credit card, we don't have social security number, we don't have, I focused a lot on the security aspects of this to make sure that if we are, I just assume we'll get compromised. So if we get compromised, what do we have that we can lose? And the best answer was, let's not have anything. If we just don't have it, then there's nothing that can be lost. So the most critical thing we have would be your email address. That's all that we even ever store anywhere. And then a user belongs to an account, and the account is the unit of billing. An account can pay for multiple people. Like an enterprise could say, I'm buying 100 seat months, and then they put those users in and out of those seats over the course of the month. So a user belongs to an account, and we actually have a feature where a user could belong to multiple accounts. Like they might have a personal account, and then maybe they work for a company, and then the company can pay for them, and they can suspend their personal account. And then when the user leaves that company sometime in the future, they quit, then they can reinstate their personal account. So associated with the user, we have all the videos they've watched. And that's associated with the user, not with the account, because as I said, you might have your own personal account, you watch these 10 videos, then maybe your company is paying for you, but you've still watched those 10 videos, right? You want to be able to see your history. You leave that company, you'd still like to be able to see the full history of everything that you've watched. This was a big change that happened for us when we architected version 2. The way that we had done counts and users in the past really wasn't working very well, and so this new layout here, which is substantially better, It's actually, the code is cleaner, the concepts are cleaner, we can present the UI cleaner, and really we added more features to it as well. So we were addressing customer and enterprise needs. So associated with each user, there's an Azure table that has all the videos that were watched by that user. And the user is the partition key in that, and so we would never have contention on the same partition key unless a single user was logged in multiple times and using the service actively from multiple different locations. Which is very unlikely to happen. So our partitioning scheme is good. That keeps our scalability, our performance really high, and it also keeps our costs low because there wouldn't be any retries on that access of the data. Associated with the user is the bookmarks. So as they're watching a video, they have the ability to put a bookmark and say, like, 10 minutes into this video, here was something I found really interesting. 20 minutes into this video, here's another thing I found interesting. So they can add these bookmarks and they can type some text with it to remind them of what it is. Then when they go to their profile page, they can see all the bookmarks they've ever set, and then they can click on it, it'll go right to that video, right to the location in the video, and start playing from there if they want to refresh their memory as to what they've been seeing. So the bookmark information for the user is also stored in an Azure table. And then users have a queue of what videos they want to add to the queue. And the queue can be ordered, like they prefer to watch this video next, and then this one next, and this one next. Because Azure tables are ordered, by alphabetically by what you put in the table, but we wanted to give the user the ability to order the contents of their queue, it wasn't a good match to put queues in an Azure table. So what we ultimately ended up doing was we put the queue information into a blob. A blob is just a sequence of bytes, but our code that we write completely controls the order of the information that's in that blob. Also, blobs are cheaper than tables as well, and blobs can be more easily moved to other services like Amazon, whereas if you try to move contents of a table somewhere else, then becomes really challenging because Amazon's tables don't work like Azure's tables and so on. So we try to avoid tables as much as possible, quite frankly, and we try to use blobs a lot because, again, they're cheaper, they're faster, and they're easier to move to some other place if we ever decide to move. The thing you get with tables that you don't get with blobs, though, is searching and filtering. And if you need to do a lot of searching and filtering, then tables is a better choice, but realize that you're going to compromise a little bit on cost, a little bit on performance, and a little bit on the ability to move your data around from service to service. Now, as I said, each account or each user is associated with one or more accounts. And accounts actually have are sponsors, if you will, for one or more users within the account. And the account is really the unit of billing. So there's an identity for the account, like who is a manager for the account. Within a company, you can actually have multiple people who are managers of an account. And then there's billing information in there. We have some customers that pay monthly by credit card. We have some customers that just send us a purchase order for maybe a year in advance. We have some customers that use PayPal, for example. So all that information is stored in an Azure table, and I'll talk more about what that actually looks like and how we designed the table a little bit later on. So that's the bulk of it, but then there's these administrative tasks too. Whenever you're running some kind of cloud service, you have all these virtual machines that are doing various things at various times, and sometimes things do go wrong. And sometimes things go right, but you still would like to have a log of what happened. For example, if somebody at a company pulls a person out of a seat and adds another person into the seat, what if that person calls us up and says, hey, I used to have a seat at this company and I don't anymore? Well, they could call us and we could say, well, on this date, this person at your company took you out of the seat and put this other person in the seat. And we need to have records of that information so that we can do this kind of customer support for people and track what's going on. So logging is a critically important part of any kind of cloud-based service. And we have created a whole logging architecture that focuses on lots of different ways of producing logs. And we have all different kinds of logs, and they're produced in different ways. And I will talk, I have slides on that a little bit later on. But the logging thing was critically important for many reasons. And of course, we want to do it fast, and we want to do it cheaply, and we want to do it typically best effort, not necessarily guaranteed. So there are chances that in Azure, a node could go down, and we may lose some log information there. But it's very unlikely that that happens. But it is possible. So the logs are really done in a best effort And usually we don't have any failures, but occasionally it's a chance that we will. And we have to realize that when a customer calls us up and we're looking at a log, there is a chance that some information may be missing from the log. If you really wanted to have logs that were absolutely consistent everywhere, it's a lot more effort. It slows things down. And then what happens if there's a bug in your logging infrastructure? You know, then you want to log that. You know, then you have a real problem. So those are the kinds of things that we thought about. So we log promo code usage. So for example, after Ignite, you know, maybe a month or two from now, Todd could look up and say, so how many people registered using the Ignite 2016 promo code? And we're expecting all of you to do that in this room, so we're going to get like six maybe or so. But you can give it out to friends and family too, and maybe it'll be a little bit higher than that. But this gives us ability to track also when we go to different trade shows. At this trade show, we had this many people register. At this trade show, we had this many people register. And that helps our marketing people know where to invest more energy in which trade shows to go to in the future. So it's useful for that. And then the account management, which was the example I gave earlier, on this date, your administrator took you out of the seat and put somebody else in the seat. Or, you know, whenever on this date we successfully billed your credit card, but on this date we were unsuccessful at billing your credit card, right? We can give that information to anybody who calls us up. Those are ongoing logs. By ongoing logs, it means we never really delete the information. We're just constantly adding to it. We usually put them in files that are on a month-by-month basis. So this is the log for January, this is the log for February, this is the log for March, and then we just kind of keep them in perpetuity. Since they're in blob storage, and Azure Blob Storage is really cheap, we can keep a lot of information in there in a very cost-effective way. And we only generally go back and read the information if a customer calls us up and they need some kind of support, or if we want to do some data mining over it, then we would go and read it. Other than that, it's mostly archival data. We have periodic logs with garbage collection. These are logs that we do roll over, like we have some retention on them, like we'll keep the last week's worth, but we only keep, or the last 7 days worth, let's say it that way, and then we will delete anything older than that because we don't want the logs, these logs, to grow without bounds. Because we want to keep our costs low of storing this stuff in Azure Storage. So we have a daily log, which is done for any errors. Any of our code that throws unhandled exceptions and causes the program to crash and fail, we want to capture those, of course, so that we can go into the code and make the code better. So every day, the first exception that's thrown on that VM for the day, that will go and create this log file, and then we'll accumulate exceptions with stack traces and other information in these, and then our developers can go and look at these log files and say, okay, this is what's going on. We get the stack trace information, and we can go and fix it. And we store these in blob storage. Some systems, like even Azure, they normally save this kind of stuff in Azure tables. I don't like using Azure tables for this kind of stuff because it's slow, it's more expensive. You can go to the table and then you can say, let me search for things in the table, but you almost never do that. And so doing the logs made it faster and cheaper, and we did it on a day-by-day basis. So we could say, well, yesterday there were no errors at all that occurred, that's great, or maybe the last week there's nothing there. Right? And then the idea is to just make that be as small as possible. And then we also have the account user watching information. So every time users are watching, we record for the account that is sponsoring that user. This user on this date watched this many minutes of this video. On this user on this date, this watched this. And this allows the administrators of an account to be able to look at the information and say, over the last month, Jeffrey Richter watched these videos for this period of time. So they can, the administrator or the company can see if they're getting a good return on investment on the product. That information is being stored in comma-separated files, and then we add it to the user interface web pages that can go and download that and then can show graphs and charts. Todd showed you some of that earlier. Also, those CSV files can simply be downloaded out of blob storage. We create a shared access signature for it, if you know what that is for blobs. And then we give a person a link on the web page. When they click that link, it goes right to blob storage, bypassing our website entirely. That increases our scalability and lowers our costs. The CSV file gets downloaded right from blob storage down to the administrator's machine, and then they could load that up in Excel or some other tool of their choice and produce whatever charts or diagrams they want to analyze it to make sure that they're getting a return of investment, or if the people on a certain team have watched the required videos to really be successful for working with certain technologies that that team within the company seems to use. Okay. And we didn't want to build everything. If we had to build absolutely everything, including, you know, the video streaming services and the transcoding and a content delivery network, you know, it's really too much for, we really only had two developers at any time working on the system, me on the back end and somebody else doing the front end. And we're not experts in a lot of these other things like payments and sending out emails and so on. So we found a bunch of third-party services that were out there. Now, this does mean that we're taking a dependency on these. So we, some of them are free, some of them we have to pay for, some of them the service might be down, what do we do if the service is down? Some of them the latency might be high, we want to make sure that our end users have a good performance experience when using our site. So we did a lot of analysis on these various different companies that were providing these various services. We compared their prices, we compared their service level agreements with one another, and then we ultimately came back with a set of them that we need. So we have an external service that we use for storing our videos and for transcoding them, and they are connected up to a content delivery network which allows the videos to stream globally across the earth so that all of our customers have a good streaming experience when watching the videos. We teamed up with a few different payment services like Stripe and PayPal so that our customers have different ways of paying for the service. And that means that they have a relationship with these other services that'll store their credit card information, which means we are not storing their credit card. So we also did it for security reasons as well, using these external services. We need to send emails out to people, like when you register on the service, or when a person at a company puts you into a seat, we want to send you an email saying, you've now been put into a seat, so you're allowed to watch videos. Or when you get removed from a seat, we want to send you an email saying, you're not allowed to watch videos anymore. The person took you out of the seat. And the person can add you, and you don't even have an account on the system. So we will email you and say, hey, this person just put you into a seat. Click on here to go and create your account. We'll add you to that, create your user account, if you will. Then we'll add you to a company account, and then you can start watching videos. So we needed email support for all of that, plus, you know, periodic marketing blasts and things like that we have to do. So we use a third-party company for that. We use a third-party company for user support, so if people have problems on the website, something isn't working correctly, they want to offer a suggestion or feature that we can add to the service, they have there's a third-party service that we use, User Voice, where they can go and enter that information in. It goes and creates tickets. That emails people within Wintellect, like our marketing people, to hear that kind of stuff, and then we can consider adding those features over time. And then whenever you watch a video, there's a forum for each video where people can go and have a discussion about what they saw on the video or maybe ask other questions. And the author of the video can contribute to the forum and answer questions that people have when they watch their content. And we use a third-party service for the forum stuff as well. So if a lot of these go down, you know, certainly if email goes down, that means we can't send you email for a day or two until it comes back up. You know, if the forums go down, that means you can't contribute to the forums, but you can still watch videos, right? And these were all kinds of things that I had to think about when designing the service so that none of these things, you know, were on the critical path. Now, obviously, if the video service goes down, you can manage your accounts, but you'll have a hard time watching a video over there. And if payment goes down, you know, then, and we can't, let's say, bill your credit card, we do have a grace period where we'll let you to continue to watch for like a day or two, and then we will assume that we're going to try billing again. So we have to have some retry logic in there for that. But again, we want you to have a good experience. So if the payment service seems to be down, we'll extend you some grace period. We'll keep trying to bill before we shut your account off. If it turns out that the billing service is up, but you know your credit card has expired, then of course we'll shut you down immediately. And next time you log in, we won't let you watch videos, but we'll tell you why, and then you can give us a new expiration date for your credit card or change it, and then we will start the billing process again, and then you can start watching videos again. Right, so these are all things that we had to think about in order to provide the service in a scalable, you know, inexpensive way and be feature rich. All right, so to go into a little bit more of the details now, the real bread and butter, as I said, is the way we manage users and accounts in the system. That's really the most important part to us. Everything else is kind of icing on the cake. But you need to be able to log in, and we need to be able to be billing you for the service because we want to make money with it. So we have this user table, which is an Azure table, and the partition key of the table is a person's email address. That's what people use to log into the system. So there's going to be one row in the table for a particular person, and the row key is just an empty string, quote, quote. So we don't use the row key for anything at all. Then when you are a new user in our system, we create a unique user ID for you. That is a GUID that is stable. So you can change your email address over time, but your user ID is a static value that will never change. So anything else that we need to know about you, like your queue, your bookmarks, your video watch history, all of that information is keyed off this static user ID. In version one of our service, it used to be that we would find those things by looking up your email address. So they were keyed off the email address. And then when a person changed their email address, we couldn't find those things anymore. So we introduced this in order to make that change. So you're able to change your email address, which is your way of logging in, but everything else is keyed off this static value that will never change over the lifetime. That really simplified things pretty dramatically for us. And then a user can be an administrator of zero or many accounts. So there's this admin of column here, which is an array of account IDs, which could be empty. So you're not an administrator of any accounts at all. Or you could be the administrator of multiple accounts within a single company, let's say. And then a user can be in a grantee of zero or more accounts, which means you're allowed to watch videos if this account is granting you access, which means they're basically paying for you. So as long as the account is still not in arrears, right? It's still valid, like their payments are up to date. If you are a grantee of that account, then you are allowed to continue to watch videos. Then we have the account table. The account table is the list of accounts that we have. The partition key is an account ID. The row key is an empty string. So again, there's really only one entry in here for each account. Then there's who are the users, who the administrators of the account. So that's an array of email addresses there. And then we have, so these are the people who can change who's being granted access within an account. And then we have a grantees column, which is an array of email addresses for the people who are being granted access to the account. Now, if a person's paying for, let's say, 100 seat months, that means that we'll never let more than 100 grantee emails be in that column at any given time. Right? If they're paying for 1,000 seat months, then we would let no more than 1,000 be in there. And our business logic and our code manages that to make sure that that constraint remains true. Then we have payment properties. So some accounts, as I said, are being paid for with a credit card. Some accounts are being paid for with a purchase order. Some accounts are being paid for by different things. The way we ultimately settled on this, I am really, really happy with. I think this worked out really great for us. And it's really taking advantage of a NoSQL database here. You wouldn't be able to do it quite as easily with a relational database, like a SQL database. But it was really easy to solve this using a NoSQL database, which is what Azure tables are. And then we need to map the Azure table information into .NET C# classes. By the way, all this stuff is written in C#. So in C#, we have an abstract base class, which is called an account. And this has some common properties for all accounts, like maybe the expiration date, for example. Then that's an abstract base class. Then derived off of that abstract base class, I have three other classes, which are sealed classes. Well, and actually there's several more than three, but I'm only showing three here on the slide. So we have a credit card account for those people who are paying with credit cards, and that's derived from account. And then that adds some additional properties that are specific to a credit card. Again, we don't store credit card numbers in our service anywhere, but we would have maybe an expiration date for when your billing has stopped. And you could prepay us with the credit card for a year, then we know that you're gonna stop 12 months in, kind of thing. So we would store that here. Then we have a direct debit account that would be derived from the same base class, and it might have some properties in it for direct debits. And then we have a purchase order account, and that's also derived from the same base class account, and that would have some properties for PO props. And if we ever added additional billing things in the future, and actually we do have some, we have Stripe, well that's a credit card one, we have PayPal, and we have some other ones, like we have free account is another one of our account types that we have. So if we ever added additional kinds of billing, we just create some new class, derive it off the account base class, and then we add whatever properties are specific for it. And then we take that account object, we can then take the various properties of it, including the base class properties, and then we put that into the payment properties column. So then when we go and read an account out of the table, we can see what properties are there, then we know to deserialize it into the correct class over here, and we're storing the data in the table exactly what we need. We don't have empty columns for things that we don't need. We can go and create new account types in the future that have new properties that we haven't even thought of today, and those will be efficiently stored in the table and efficiently retrieved from the table, so it'll be cheap. It's easier for us to add new accounts, and this worked out phenomenally great for us. So we're really happy with this architecture and the way that this is working. And this was all done in our version 2. Our version 1 was not good. The version one stuff, the way we handled payment, we had all the properties for every kind of billing that we had, all in every row. Some of them would be zero, some would be minus one, some would be empty, and it was much harder to go and look things up. It was also easy where we could go and use tooling to scan over the table, and we could say, so how many credit card customers do we have? How many purchase order customers do we have? And it's pretty easy to do a query across that account table to get that kind of information now. This worked out. I mean, there's so many benefits of doing it this way. It really worked out well. So adding and removing accounts, this is kind of some of the logic that we have for doing that. We have a cardinal rule, right, that whenever we wrote code anywhere in the system, the cardinal rule was an account never trusts a user. That's the default. That means that you are, by default, not allowed to watch a video under any given account that you're a part of, unless that account is not in arrears, right? Its payment status is good. So that's our first rule. Then we have to disprove the default by making sure that the account is not in arrears. So this is the logic that we use for having an administrator add and remove a user to a particular account. First, and because tables is an eventual consistency model, we can't do this with transactions. For consistency, we had to write this code in a certain order, has to be done in a certain order, and it has to be replayable so that it's idempotent as well, because it might get replayed back multiple times due to the eventual consistency models that tables provide. So we update the account. That means we add a user to the array of users for a particular account. Like, imagine somebody, a company, is saying Jeff can now go watch a video. So we're adding Jeff to this account, saying that Jeff's allowed to watch videos. And then we send an email notification to the user saying you have just been added to this account, so you're now allowed to watch videos. In the email, we have a URL that they can click on to basically accept that they have been granted into this. And they can click on that multiple times, right? Because what's to stop you from clicking on that multiple times? And again, our code had to be idempotent to make sure that if you clicked on it multiple times, you were really only added to the account just once, right? Not multiple times. And an admin can also resend this email if necessary. So if a person says, hey, I never received the email, then they can tell the admin person, said, hey, you told me you're going to put me in the seat. You never did. Then the person can go back to our portal, click a button, and we will resend the email to that person with the link in it so that they can go and be added to the system. Right, so we had to think through all these, you know, workflow scenarios to make sure that everything was idempotent throughout the system. That was the hard part. The actual writing of the code to make it all work was actually pretty simple and straightforward, but thinking through all the scenarios and make sure you got it right was the tricky part to it. So then the user is going to go and click on that link that's inside the email. Now, that's going to take them to our website. We're going to look up the user, but they may not exist, right? The admin could have put them in by their email address. That's what people use to log into the system, but we may not have a user account for them yet. So if we don't have, then we take them to the registration page, and they start to fill out the registration there. And then now that they're a new user, we have to then associate them with the account. So we make sure that that happens next. And if the account knows the user, then we will add the account to the user. So in other words, when the person registers, we check to see if the account that they're trying to register with has still granted them access. Because another scenario is the administrator grants access to Jeff, and then before Jeff ever clicks on the link, the administrator took Jeff out of the seat and put Fred into the seat instead. So now when Jeff goes and clicks on the link, should they be allowed to have access or shouldn't they? And the answer is they should not, because the administrator has removed them from a seat and they're not allowed to watch videos anymore, right? So there's all these race conditions. We had to think through these scenarios and we had to write the code accordingly. So when a person signs up, we check to make sure that the admin still is granting them the seat. And if they are, then we will add them and so they can watch videos. If not, then we will remove them from the account, and that operation has to be idempotent so it can be replayed back multiple times with no ill effect. That's the kind of thinking, right, that I need to employ as I was building various parts of the service. And we use this kind of thinking in various other locations throughout the service as well. Again, the actual code is not hard to write. It's the thinking through all the scenarios and the race conditions and the item potency, if this happens multiple times, that's the hard part about thinking all of that through to make sure that the service is really reliable and robust. So by writing the code this way, it solved all these problems. The user never clicks an email for whatever reason. Maybe they just never got the email. Well, the administrator can go back and resend it. Right? The user clicks the email multiple times. We had to make sure that code was idempotent, and we had to make sure that the, that's the third one now, the user clicks the email after another administrator removes permission. Then we can't just give the person permission. We have to make sure they don't get it because the administrator is not allowing it anymore. And a malicious user changes the URL to an account not granting access that ends up being treated as above. So, right, there's nothing to stop somebody from just creating their own URL and clicking on it, right? So we had to make sure that the URL itself was secure and that it made sense, right? And we solved all of those pretty easily. All right, so now you're a user, you're logged into the system, and you're using the system. So there is some information that we store on your behalf. We have this watched video table. This is a list of all the videos that you have watched. It's really for your video history. So the table looks like this in Azure. We have the partition key, which is the user ID. So these are associated with you. The row key is the video ID. So we know for which video you have, which means there's only one row in the table for any given user for any single video. There is the timestamp, the date time, which is put in there by Azure. So that's out of our control. But really, it indicates the last time this row in the table was updated. Then we have the offset within the video where you were. This allows you to click on this history. It'll go right to that video and pick up right from where it left off, the offset in the video. And then you can continue watching from that point. And then we also store in here how many minutes of the video you have watched. And of course, you can watch a video five times over from beginning to end, and then we will have the total number of minutes in here that you have watched of the video. These are grouped by user within the table. So when we need to go and say, when you log in, and say, okay, Jeff has just logged in, what's his history? We can go right to the table and say, give me all the rows with a partition key for Jeff. And then it'll go right to that location in the table and give me the history for Jeff. So it was very fast to be able to grab that history for a particular user. It's easy to update a specific video. So as you're watching a video, we need to update it. We know who you are, the partition key, and we know which video you're watching, the row key, so we know exactly what row in the table to go to do the update. So that's blazingly fast. With the timestamp, we could say, so let's do a scan over the table, which videos have been watched in the last day? And then we can use the timestamp column to scan the entire table, and we can see what videos have been watched most recently in the last day. And then the client-side application, meaning the website, or if you're using our mobile app, if you would like to sort your history in terms of most recently watched as opposed to, by default, this will be alphabetical by the name of the video. But if you would like to watch it in timestamp, then you could easily sort by time instead, and usually your history is, I don't know, a couple hundred videos at most, maybe 10 videos, 100 videos, whatever you've watched on the system. So having the clients do actual other sorting for the end user's benefit is a very cheap thing to do because we return a severe subset of the data back to you and there's not that much of it. Now we have a bookmark table. As I mentioned, as you're watching a video, you can click on it and say, I would like to bookmark this location within the video, and then you can add some text that's meaningful for you. So we have a bookmark table. Again, the partition key is the user. The row key is the video. Then we have the timestamp, again, put there by Azure. And then for the bookmarks, it's just one column, and we just make it an array, a byte array. And inside that byte array, we store the offset of the videos within that particular video and some note, right, which is your textual note that you have there. So the benefits of this is, again, they're grouped by user and video, just like they are for the watched video table. So it's easy when you log in and you go to your profile page, we can just quickly go to the table and say, give me all the bookmarks for Jeff. And if you go to a particular video, we can say, give me all the bookmarks for Jeff on this particular video. That would just be one row in the table. So blazingly fast to look this stuff up and to go and add new entries to it. So it's easy lookup or fast lookup. And again, we can do filtering to the last number of days. I added a bookmark in the last week. Can you just show me the bookmarks I added in the last week? It's trivially simple for us to have the client-side apps do that kind of filtering. And then the last thing that we have for a user is the video queue, and that's a blob container. We don't use tables for this. We use a blob container for this. And within the container, the blob name is the user ID. So each user on our system has a separate blob that has binary data. The reason, again, why we don't use a table for this is because tables always sort their information. But we want to let the user have control over the order of the elements that are in their queue, which video they want to watch next, which video they want to watch last, and so on. So we decided a table's not good for that. We're going to use a blob for that instead. And then we write the code where the user does the ordering, and then we will write the information as the blob in the desired order of the user. So the queue items are manipulated all together. Since all the queued items are in a single blob, they're always manipulated all together as a single unit, which is good. When you add a new item to the queue, we can just append to the end of the blob. So that's really simple. We have to read the blob, append to the end, write it back out. That's easy. We can easily remove something from your queue that's in the middle of it. We just read the blob, pull it out, write the whole blob back out. And then we can do, you know, showing whatever we want to show or order whatever we want to show, but we'll just have the client applications, the website or the mobile apps, go and do that for you. Just by they can download your queue right from blob storage, and then the client apps can do whatever they want to with it. So again, I think a really good architecture here, very cheap, scales really well for us. I mentioned earlier about the logging infrastructure. Wow, I'm really using a lot of time, Todd. How about that? And that's really, when you're building anything for the cloud, it's really worth spending a phenomenal amount of time on the logging infrastructure. It can help you in so many different ways if you do it right. So we use blobs, not tables. Again, blobs are faster, blobs are cheaper. You can't do filters, but you can download the blob, which can be a CSV file, and then you can load it into other things like Excel, and then you can do filters. So that's typically why we did it. The logging infrastructure is best effort, as I said, so there's a chance that if a VM goes down, we're going to lose some data, but that's really always true. So as long as the VMs are up and running, we're really good at having all the log information and having none of it get lost. The logging is done asynchronously. That is, whenever we want to log something, we call a piece of code that says, this needs to be logged, but we don't put that code in the user's path, because we don't want something wrong with the logging infrastructure or latency to affect the end user experience. So if an administrator adds a person, you know, grants them access to the system, we write that to a log file. But we do that asynchronously, and we let the result come back right away instead, so that they're not waiting for the logging to happen. That gives a quicker response time in the application. We have two different kinds of logs. The first is an ongoing log. This keeps the last 55,000 entries. Or 50,000 entries. The reason why is we use block blobs in Azure, and block blobs in Azure support up to 50,000 blocks in a single blob. So we just keep appending new blocks to the end of the blob, and once it hits 50,000, we delete from the beginning and we append to the end. So we always store the last 50,000 entries in here. So that means we'll lose earlier stuff, but you know, if we lose it, we probably don't care about it because it was 50,000 entries ago when we lost it. So we use this for our promo code usage and for people who are registering on the system. We have a record of the last 50,000 people who've registered on the system, you know, very easily. And then beyond that, we can throw some of that data away so we're not paying for it all. But we'll, of course, have their user accounts and everything else in the system. That's permanent. And account management operations, when users get grant access or revoked access, those are being written out too. And again, we store 50,000 of them. That's 50,000 per company, by the way, for that particular thing. So if a company has a problem, we can look at the last 50,000 admin operations that have occurred. But we just don't let it grow without bounds, right? We don't want things to grow without bounds because it's very expensive to do that. And then most of that data just sits there and you never access it, but you end up paying for it on a monthly basis. Then the other kind of log we have is a periodic log. And I wrote a bunch of code to make these things really easy to write inside of our code base. You can have like a daily periodic log or a weekly or a monthly or a quarterly, and then you can tell it how many of these. Like for daily, you can say, this is a log over the last 7 days, and then it will purge old ones and only keep the last 7 days worth. Again, it's a cost-cutting measure to do that. And also, it kind of reduces the amount of data that you have to look over if you need to go and look over some data. So you're not spending a lot of time perusing data that's, you know, 2 years old in the system. So we use this for errors handling, unhandled exceptions, and that's in a daily log. And we keep the last, like, you know, month's worth, 30 days worth of the daily logs of exceptions. And we have a count user transcript, like the user watching history, and this is done on a monthly basis for the billing cycle. And then an admin can go and say, over the last month, I was billed for this. What videos were watched over the last month? Who in my company watched them? How many minutes of each one did they watch? All that information is available for them to download. As I was writing all of this stuff, I tried to write it in a, I worked on class libraries a lot in my life, and I was on the .NET framework team at Microsoft for 8 years as a consultant there. And during that time, I worked on a lot of the class libraries that you, as a .NET programmer, use today. So I got in the habit of trying to, when I write code, I try to write it in a reusable fashion. Let me build a class library that can be reused in lots of different scenarios. So as I was working on this, I ended up building a document called Jeffrey Richter's Guide to Working with Azure Storage Tables, because I learned a lot about Azure Storage Tables, good ways to use them, bad ways to use them, ways that'll hurt you if you try to version your data in the future, ways that'll make it really easy for you to version your future in the data, version your data in the future, cost-cutting measures, performance measures, and so on. So I wrote this really big document about that, and that document has been endorsed by Microsoft's Azure Storage team, and it's available for free. You can download it from this link over here. And then I go into what the guide's purposes are down below. You know, some of Microsoft's recommendations are actually not good recommendations at all that will really get you into trouble. I followed them myself, and I got burned by them. So I explain what recommendations are bad and why and what to use instead in this document. I show good patterns and practices related to working with Azure Tables. And then I created a class library with a bunch of utility code, which is all open source and available on, you can download the DLL on NuGet, and then the source code is available as well. And it has a lot of helper classes in it. So for blob features, I have logging, the ongoing logs and the periodic logs, where you can just say, I need to have a daily log and keep the last 7 of them. And then it has APIs where you can call to write to it, and then it will just do it asynchronously and update the logs for you, and it will do the garbage collection to get rid of the old logs. So that's all code you wouldn't have to write if you use this class library that I have. The periodic elector, sometimes you need to pick one machine, elect one machine to do, like run a report. Right, so we have 10, let's say, machines running in Azure, and on Saturday night at midnight, we want to produce a report. So we want to elect one of the 10 machines to be the one to produce the report. So I have code in this library that will form an election across those 10 machines. So one of them will be chosen as the elected winner, and that one will generate the report. And if that machine goes down while it's producing the report, then one of the other 9 machines will become the elected winner, and it will go and produce the report. Right? So that kind of resiliency, which is really hard to do, we needed that, and so I wrote it in this reusable class library. For a table, I have a bunch of code in there that will do backup and restore of a table. So we do backup our tables periodically. We do this for disaster recovery. We also do it in case there's a bug in our code or in case we get hacked. We can go back to a previous version of a table, and we can go and restore it. So that was also important for us. We have I have code in here to help with optimistic concurrency, make it easier to create a filter for doing a query against a table, make it easier for write code to go through the various segments of enumerating information that's in a table. Sometimes we've wanted to replace the names of properties in a table, or delete a property in every entry of a table, or add a property to every entry of a table. So I have some helper code in there that does all of that. I have a pattern for extensible entity schemas. This gives you that versioning, easy way to version things in the future. And a way to take a collection of items, serialize them into a byte array, so you can put them into a single property of a table. Like we use that for our bookmarks. We use that for our, well, a similar thing we use for our queue, the user's queue of what videos they want to watch. And all this is downloadable from that link down there at the bottom. All right, I think we're done.
Is that it?
I think so.
Well, let me make 2 quick points then, because we're 1 minute at a time. One thing that's fascinating when you do a real product, when I say real product, I mean something that's out there, you know, in commercial production, and then you look at this system, I look at it every day, and it looks like, hey, you sign in, there's a user, and there's videos, and there's a library. It looks like nothing, but every single little bit of like user accounts or payments. We didn't talk about promotions, or what if somebody cancels a payment here. The payment options we tried, we had a lot of lessons learned. We tried PayPal, we tried different things, we found all kinds of...
Like people in Germany won't use PayPal?
Well, there's customer issues like that. There's also programmatic stuff and how you access and how you report on it. But every single little thing, I remember you and Joel and me at a whiteboard once just talking about users and accounts. And it was spaghetti. I mean, it was just everywhere because of what we wanted to do. We wanted to have accounts that were just a single user, simple. But what if you're a business account and you can assign multiple users? Then we had all kinds of different things like, what do we call them, seat month accounts or something?
Seat
I can't even remember.
Right.
Where people wanted to buy blocks of seats. I don't want to get into it, but we had 7 billing types of accounts at one point. It's just the challenges are just fascinating to deal with. The last point I wanted to make, because it was the whole point of the architecture and optimization, is what does this thing cost, right? When we first started, and we've learned from version 1 to version 2, and with accounts and payments and PayPals and Stripe and all kinds of things, it cost us roughly $1,500 to $3,000 a month, I think, something along those lines. We've gotten that down to almost an order of magnitude less. It's just a few hundred to several hundred a month at this point. And that was through choosing different CDNs and edge server companies that stream this in different ways. And we got one. We had to make some trade-offs in the video players and stuff, but it's basically costing us a few hundred a month to service thousands and thousands and thousands of users. And that's all in accepting investments in videos, meaning hiring people to do the videos. You take that out, and this is a few to several hundred dollars a month, all on Azure, paying for the Azure storage, the hosting, the VMs, everything. It's just several hundred dollars a month. And I can guarantee that none of our competitors are within that order or two orders of magnitude of that number. So that's Jeffrey's architecture, and that's some of the good things that came out of all this. So we're done. Any questions you have? I can't believe we...
I know.
You and I were like, what are we going to do? We're going to disappoint the audience. We'll have a 30-minute conversation.
Apparently I can ramble on a lot more than I thought.
Yeah. So any questions?
Anything you'd like to talk about? Yes? We do not use Azure queues anywhere in the model. That is correct. But what's that? No, it had nothing to do with cost. In fact, I think the costs are pretty good. And there's a little bit higher latency on that, but there was just never a need for it in anything that we're doing to do any kind of queuing.
So when you have a message going out to the user, you click on
this
link, activate the service.
So we send that to SendGrid, is the service that we use for email. And then they have to deal with emailing it. Yes, and that's it. And so if they never get the email, the administrator has to log back into our site, and they click a button on us that says resend it, and then we will resend it to SendGrid, and then they will go and send the email again. Maybe they had the email incorrect, or for whatever reason it got lost. But yeah, we don't use Azure queues, just not because there's anything wrong with them. I've used them in other things that I've built, but in here there was just no need for them. You have a question?
You are taking the number of minutes that user is engaging, right?
Yes.
Do you have any request to measure how many distinct minutes of the video that user is just watching?
Sort of. So the question is, do we have a way of knowing distinct minutes of a video that a user is watching? Yeah, we do have a way to do that. And actually, the way we solve that, I think, is actually kind of clever. So we take a video, let's say it's an hour long, and we divide it down into, I can't remember the exact number, 3-minute chunks. Yeah. Maybe it's 3-minute chunks. And if you're watching anywhere in the first 3 minutes of it, we set bit 0 of an integer to a 1. And if you watch it over and over and over again, we just keep setting that bit to 1. Right? So and if you seek somewhere in the video, then you're in some other 3-minute segment. So we do it with a 3-minute resolution. So you're in that. Well, then we will go and update this integer, and we'll set the bit for that 3-minute section of the video to a 1. Then we can look at all the videos that people have watched. We grab these like 64-bit integers, or maybe I can't remember, 32-bit or 64-bit integer. But then we can look at all the bits that are set, and we would multiply each bit set by 3 minutes. And we know how much you've watched distinct, given that 3-minute granularity. That's how we solve that.
Although bookmarks are exact.
Okay. You did the same thing? Okay, great. You know, great minds think alike. Good. What's that?
Also does it in the same way.
Okay, I don't know. Possibly. But we arrived at it on our own. We didn't look up what somebody else did. But I would imagine it's a common thing for people to do, and that's what we ended up doing as well. So it, again, it's very cheap, right? We're only storing integer, 32-bit or 64-bit for each video, for per user. And then we just get it, flip a bit, and if it hasn't changed, we don't even have to write it back, right? If the bit was a 1 and we're making it a 1, we don't even have to write it back. But if it was a 0 and we make it a 1, then we can write it back out. Play the video from email?
Do you have
from Vimeo.
Any special clients on the client side for playing video, or do you outsource the video playing features to Vimeo.com? I saw from
Vimeo is what you saw. Is that what you're asking, what the video player is?
Yeah.
So we've used a few. We've tried 3 or 4 over the years.
Okay. That's been our biggest pain point, I would say.
One of our biggest pain points. Because we wanted an all HTML5, you know, type editor. So I won't mention the older ones, but the last two that we used, and this is one of those challenges and trade-offs, were Vidler for a while, if you've heard of Vidler, and Vimeo. And Vidler started to get more and more and more expensive as we scaled, and they wanted to charge more in a premium level of service. And despite their, despite the premiums we were paying, in some parts of the country, like areas of India or some area of Australia, we'd just get this flood of complaints that we could not figure out. You know, none of it was us, it was the CDNs we were using. So we tried video player after video player. And the reason it's a bunch of a trade-off is each video player is different. Some people like one, some like the other, some have back and forth and video playback speeds, and some don't. The controls look different. We have actually Vidler and Vimeo in place right now. But we're moving at the moment almost all to Vimeo because the performance has been better all around globally. We have almost no complaints of any kind anymore, no matter what location. And they're by far the best value and price. So that few hundred to several hundred dollars a month that I told you, that's including all the bandwidth requirements. I wasn't excluding that. That's literally what it costs us to host this thing. And we have competitors that are paying 7 figures a year for their hosting services. So, you know, you basically, I'm saying, you accomplished all your goals.
I'm very proud of it. I worked on it for a long time.
Yeah. Did that answer your question?
And it was fun. It was a fun project.
We are using Vimeo and Vidler.
How can you just create the chunks of videos? Does the Vimeo player give you that information as well?
He's saying, how can you jump to a location within Vimeo, into a video using Vimeo? Don't we get, so I'm not involved in this part of it because this is in the user interface. It's not in the back end. But I know what we did with Vidler is with the player, we would get notifications of where you are in the video.
Yeah. So there's an API.
Our JavaScript would get that. When it's running in the browser, our JavaScript would receive notifications from the player. You're here, you're here, you're here, you're here. That JavaScript code would call into my back end code to say this user, this video is at this location. I go to the table, grab their integer, flip the bit. If the bit is changed, I write it back. If it didn't change, I throw it away. And that's all I had to do.
Yeah, all the players have an API, you know, to interact with.
I'm assuming the Vimeo player does the same thing. Again, that's on the JavaScript part. So they're still calling me in the back.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know what notification they've hooked into for the Vimeo player to be able to call me.
If I remember correctly, it's very similar. There's always some, what's your location in the video thing going on you can access.
And when the user hits pause or stop, the browser also sends me a notification saying for this user at this video, they're at this location. So when they go to the history, we can continue from where they left off. We also update that as they're watching it too, but it's better if the person hits stop or pause on the video because then we know exactly where they are. Other than that, we don't send constant stream of notifications from the browser to the back as they're watching the video. It's too much network traffic. And we pay for all those updates. So it's on once a minute or something. So if they go back, you know, if they just leave the web page and come back, we'll get them close, like within a minute or so of where they were, but it won't be exact. If you hit pause or stop, then we'll know exact really where you are on the video. Okay, I think.
Anything else?